The history of man begins really with the history of cultures, civilizations. And very early on in human history, we see the development of very specific features of culture, which is religion. Religion originally, and by the middle of this, you understand why I'm talking about this first. Religion really started off as an agricultural religion. Many of the aspects that we find of religion back then are feminine features. You know, you even find, if you ever come to Israel and you ask me to take the Israel Museum, I'll show these things to you. You have like little stones, size of the palm of my hand, which is pretty sort of a bit smaller than the palm of my hand, is pretty big, but you know, stones that have eyes and markings of breasts and female reproductive organs. And very simple things. But you see how these images develop more and more, and they become a lot more explicit. And there's a lot of emphasis on fertility. And everyone knows the fertility worship in the ancient Near East, but you don't even know the half of it. It was the core of religion. Before there were gods of wisdom and war and so on, the first gods were gods of fertility, because that was the core thing for people. Survival, living, eating. And they understood that nature is out of their control, so they interpreted this as being gods. Now, in time, when people started gathering together as societies, they started building cities. This is where calendars come into play. Let's start with the cities. So the cities basically build up out of a need to protect oneself, to build mutual interests and so on, living in caves and really cut it anymore. And people prefer to start living together because they realize if they work together, they can develop things that they only, instead of having to, I have to make everything, beginning from my clothing to my food to my weapons and my tools and so on, they start realizing, we need to work together and we'll be able to build up something. They start developing villages. Villages turned into cities. Cities started developing into administrative structures. And religion became part of the city. This is why we have patron gods. And temples were erected. Temples became banks. Temples were strongly connected to the city itself, to the king, and so on. This is why many of the kings were priestly kings. It's very common in Assyria and Babylon. I'll mention something about Assyria and Babylon later, so you get the idea of how important these cities were for these groups, especially the temples and so on. And what happens is that each area has to develop its own system because of the fact that it has a different aspects of nature. What we need to understand as well here is that calendars are strongly connected to religion. But religion is not just the religious service, okay? It's not just the festivals. The moment cities became cities, the moment temples were built, they became the center of everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. What it meant was, besides the practices of this ritual and that ritual and this festival and whatever and this parade and so on. By the way, to this very day, parades, people go on parades. The history of parades has to do with religion, with parading around the city with your god. If you always think about it, at the end of the day, many of our practices today as people are strongly connected to religion, to what people did back then. There was there was a parade done in every 4 years in Athens in honor of Athena. They would parade her statue, and by the way, there was several statues. One of them was a huge one that you couldn't parade, but you paraded every year. You paraded a statue, and there was one special parade every 4 years, which I can't remember what the name of that parade was, because they had a lot of different parades and a lot of different festivals and so on. Every 4 years they would parade her with this brand new garment. They had the virgins of Athena, who for 4 years wove this magnificent garment that also had the images of the deities. And it took a while to make this thing because it was very, very detailed. But every 4 years, they will redress her in a new robe. But part of the point was to walk around with this gigantic statue in the streets. And to this very day, Catholics do the same thing. There was even one video I once saw, very unfortunate for them. For me, it's like, okay, it's another statue. But where they were parading around with a statue of the Virgin Mary, and it fell and broke. And it smashed in the middle of the church. A lot of people, they were very embarrassed. But the point is that a lot of what we do today, and a lot of what we experience as people today, is strongly connected to all of these things. So what happened is that if you have a temple, you have a center of power. If your king happens to be also your priest, this way, by the way, in the Torah, they're separated from one another. There actually is a separation of religion and state in the Torah to some degree. Now, everyone was religious, but the crown and the temple are not supposed to be connected to one another. This is part of the struggle of the first temple. We can get to that some other time. But the point is that you had to pay tribute to the temple and you also had to pay taxes. Now, a tax year and a festival year are not necessarily at the same time. It was very common that the festivals fell based on the agricultural, not cycle, but experience. Now, what do you mean by experience? That moment where spring comes, things come back to life. In a lot of the practices in this region, especially the religion or the cult of Tammuz or Damuz, also pronounced as Damuzi, where Damuzi in the myths gives up. It's like this. There's several stories. One is a competition between Damuzi and another man. One of them represents agriculture. The other one represents the shepherds. And I think Damuzi represents the agriculture. And there's a struggle between him and the person represents shepherds over the love of this woman. And I think one of them has to give up. I can't remember what it was, but Damuzi. One of the stories about Damuzi is that he dies. There's actually a very interesting, again, in the Israel Museum. There's this interesting wall carving that they pulled out of a wall somewhere where you see Damuzi, who's represented as like almost like a tree-like type of thing. He's like a head that has like spikes coming up and hands that go out with the fingers sticking out as if they're like this, as if they're like branches as well. And there's an image of him on the lying down, then another image of him standing up. And the whole idea is that to do with the death of Damuzi and then his resurrection. Baal cycles also have this whole thing of Baal dying and then coming back to life. There's a whole connection between life and death and nature coming back to life and so on. And they were strongly connected to the whole cycle and everything. So a lot of religious calendars, this is where we start seeing the separation, a lot of religious calendars were connected to the spring, to the time of Nisan, March, April, where things come back to life in the Northern Hemisphere, because most people didn't really know much about the Southern Hemisphere at the time. And they had that. So in the beginning, one of the calendars that existed was the calendar that had to do with nature. When nature comes back to life, when nature goes to sleep, when it rains, the winter is considered to be the time of in Hebrew is the Horef, which is the time of darkness. I posted something not long ago about Horef and darkness and Horfi. It has to do with darkness and dark hair. And then you have the Aviv, the time of spring when everything comes back to life. And then the time of the kites, it's when you gather fruit and dry it. It's not really half stuff. In the Bible, there's really just kites and Horef. Aviv is not really a time, is not really a season in the Bible. Today we call it Aviv, and it's really used out of actual context. Aviv has nothing to do with what we call spring. It has to do with the state of the grains, which is something we'll explain about today. And so that was all nice and dandy when they only had to pay, to the temples, when they had to pay tribute to the gods and so on. However, in time, as I said, the development of cities, and really if you take any major history book, you'll see that the first half of the book, if you take Kuhler's book, then I think his name was, no, Kult, Kuhler, Kult. If you take his book, it's a very, very long and very dry read because it highly details some of the very early points of what we know of early culture of man. He takes a very, very long time explaining this development and structure. But the point is that the moment cities came into play and people started seeing themselves as leaders and started claiming that they are descendants of gods, and therefore also took names like the son of this deity. In the East, they were like that. In the West, or Greece and so on, they didn't really have worship of the throne. That's really more of an Eastern culture, an Eastern concept that came later on because of Alexander the Great conquests in the end of the fourth century in the East. But people worshipped a lot of the kings as gods. And kings that, for example, were not descendants of, say, the previous king and so on, had to take some kind of an excuse that there was some kind of spiritual descent, or they were also descendants of this god, and therefore they have the right to rule. The name Sargon, if I'm not mistaken, is really one who rules with right. Sargon, this is what I remember, that's what the name means. What's interesting is that sometimes Sargon can also be pronounced as Sulchin. Sargon II built a place called Dur Sulchin, the city of Sargon, so it's interesting it's pronounced like that as well. Has to do with the difficulty of pronouncing Assyrian words because you're using Sumerian symbols, and Sumerian symbols don't really necessarily correspond with Akkadian and Assyrian, so that sometimes there's other ways of reading something. So, but in any case, they became strongly connected to the temples, but you can't run a country without taxes. Taxes have to be connected to the physical. They can't be connected to the ritual, because the ritual commemorates something completely different. Ritual is more standing before the gods and saying, thank you for bringing the sun back, thank you for bringing life back, thank you for this wonderful air, and the rain, and the spring, and that we can go around dancing in the fields and doing some other stuff there as well. And what happens is that you also need taxes. This requires creating a separate calendar. Now, each area is different. If you live in a country where it rains, so your physical year ends at winter. On the other hand, if you live, for example, near the Nile in Egypt, your physical year ends when you're done harvesting after the flooding. This created several separate calendars in the ancient world that existed side by side, and some of them, in many cases, had two calendars existing side by side. And in Egypt, I would even say there was a third, but in Egypt, there's a very simple problem with Egypt. There were several dynasties, and each dynasty was someone else who usurped the throne, and they wanted to emphasize this god or that god, so they changed the calendar. So in Egypt, they had a lot of stages about the calendar, which creates a massive mess, you know, in people who study calendars. You'd be aware of the fact that there was like three or four different calendars. Some of them existed side by side. Some of them existed in different times because of these different struggles. So let's talk about Babylon first. Let's talk about, but when you say Babylon, you're really talking just about the cities. Let's talk about Mesopotamia, because the Assyrians and Babylonians more or less shared a culture, to a point that one of my professors, when we were talking about the conquest of Jerusalem, kept on saying the Assyrians destroyed Jerusalem. And I obviously, sheepishly, because I studied the period, and I studied another course, and I said, what do you mean Assyrians? It was the Babylonians. And she basically said, Assyrians, Babylonians, same thing. So I said, true, but you have to say it's the Babylonians, because the Babylonians were the people that Babylon was the city that controlled Ashur. So it's Babylonians if we go according to the leadership. But here, for now, we're going to say Mesopotamia, Assyria, Babylon, parts of the Zagros Mountains and parts of Persia. So they basically had two calendars simultaneously. They had the calendar that started in spring and the calendar that started in winter. And these were two separate calendars that existed side by side. These calendars took into consideration the fact that they wanted the Akitu celebration. That's the nothing new. It's not really a New Year celebration, but it's kind of a New Year celebration. They celebrated the creation of the world. I mentioned earlier that I mentioned something about the Akitu as well. The Akitu was a ceremony where they would take out the statue of Mordoch. And for those who remember the first lesson we had all the way back over 2 years ago, I spoke about the Enuma Elish. And I, with very broken Sumerian, tried to read the Enuma Elish. Now I can know how to read it a little bit better now that I practiced it. But the Enuma Elish is this creation story, the Sumerian Babylonian creation story. In the creation story, Marduk goes out to battle against Tiamat and Epsu. He kills Tiamat, and from Tiamat is the goddess of the dragon goddess or the monster goddess of salt water, Epsu. Or I think his name is Epsu, is the god of sweet water. He battles them, the whole legend of, you know, water trying to conquer the world and the world being covered with water and so on. He kills her. From her body, he builds the world. He builds the world so the gods won't have to work hard to eat. So a very complete different story about how the world was created, different purpose, different ideas. So there's really no connection between these stories except for the fact that this whole thing with water. He defeats her, takes over, builds his own palace in the heavens. He becomes king over all the gods, even the older gods, gods who were actually older than him, which raises a question about how what exactly the Babylonians believed about the gods. The book of Genesis actually stands in contradiction to this, to the Babylonian belief that gods were born and they died, which is, by the way, very similar to some of the Greek mythology. If you remember the Durians and many of the Greek peoples, the Durians and the Achaeans, which dwelt in Achaea, which is basically the area of Sparta, the Durians, which were north of that, in the area of known as Etica, they actually came from the east. So they took a lot of these stories with them. And one of the things that they teach and study Greek theology and mythology is they believed in something which was very similar to evolution. There were always gods, but they kept on being born and they developed and developed and developed. And then you had the Titans and so on. And then Zeus battled his own father, and then he becomes the king of the gods. But the expectancy was that he will also be usurped and his position be taken away from him. So it seems to be, if you read the Enuma Elish, it seems to be this is exactly what a lot of Babylonians believed in. But the Akitu basically was a celebration of the creation of the world, rethroning Marduk as king of the world, as king of the universe. And the whole ceremony was that they actually took out his statue and they would parade him around. So actually holding the statue was also very important. And one of the really most important points in history where the Akitu was not celebrated is during the times of King Nebunaid, who was, if I remember correctly, the last king of Babylon before he was conquered by the Chaldeans. He was conquered by the Medes, then later the Persians. And he went into exile for about 10 years in the deserts, the Arabian deserts. And that created a big conundrum in Babylon and Assyria. Also, you know, the statue sometimes traveled to other places, but there was a lot of ceremonies there and so on. So that was the Akitu. That's where the Akitu began. There is literally no connection between the Akitu and Rosh Hashanah or Yom Tov'ah or the month of Nisan, the month of Aviv. Really, there's no elements whatsoever. It's very common to hear people claim this. These claims, by the way, are based on very old research, on very old studies from way back in the 1950s, when, you know, even before that. These are based on old studies, on old ideas, things which today More modern scholars completely reject. It's very common that you hear people's arguments and they're based on a lot of old material. There's some books out there which are old and they're awesome, but there are a lot of books out there that I keep on seeing people quoting from. And these are old books. They belong to the old school of study, things that have been proven as being incorrect. However, even with that being said, these books are worth reading. It's worth looking into them because there are still things which are, to this very day, to the point. The Akito, by the way, was expanded. The Akito was actually expanded into the seventh month, as we call it in the Bible, the month of Tishrei or Tashritu, as they called it in Babylon, out of a need. There was apparently a need to create a festival then, or to move the festival to there, because there's something that has to do with the king and something that has to do with the whole system there. But regardless of that moving there, we need to also remember that these are pivotal points in time anywhere in the world, especially if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, and therefore it is natural for many other cultures to have similar calendars and to have similar responses. People always talk about this whole thing of the calendar, the Hebrew calendar being an imitation of this and that calendar. And this is not true. These are just universal concepts, and there are universal ideas here that everyone had to share. Everyone. The sun rises. I can't say it's nighttime. It's daytime, and I have to deal with the fact that there's light outside. You know, it's wintertime. I have to deal with the fact that days are shorter and it's raining, or hopefully it's going to rain. Things like that. So it's very superficial, very, very superficial to make these claims. Now, excuse me. Another thing to point out here as well is the fact that the Akito had to be celebrated at specific points in time in the year. So the Babylonians, living also more in a northern area, had to add a month to the year, so the Akito will fall on springtime and the end of summer, beginning of autumn. They had to do this because they knew that there are several cycles. So it seems to be that in Babylon, besides these points that I pointed out, they also had a lunar solar calendar, which means they had the months. The word Chodesh and the word Yireach are both used to indicate month. Chodesh relates to the word Chadash, which is new. Yireach is another word for moon. And they had to do that because they were a rain-based culture. Their year was governed by the rain. So that's northern Mesopotamian solar. Then we go to Egypt. Egypt, besides the whole mess I mentioned earlier regarding the calendars, that they each, you know, dynasties chose calendars, and there were temples that came into play as well. In Egypt, there was a very, very strong connection between the pharaohs being gods and the temples and who do you support and so on. And just a little anecdote there. Everyone knows the Tutankhamun. Now, if I break down his name was Tut Anak Amun. But do you know what his original name was? His original name was Tut Anak Atun. His father was Akhnatun. And Akhnatun was the pharaoh, the heretic pharaoh, who produced the letters, who was connected to the letters of El Amarna, and built the city of Akhtatun, which is the city of Atun. And he corresponded with a lot of chieftains in the land of Israel. Back then it was known as the land of Amuru, or the land of Canaan later. And there's a lot of interesting things about biblical Hebrew that we get from these letters. A lot of little glossaries there that give us insight of what the language looked like at the time. A glossary is an entry of information. It's kind of different or outside of the scope of what's being detailed in the letter itself. I'll talk about this more in detail. I think one of my videos actually mentions this. And the reason he had a name change is because after his father died, he was actually very young. And as commonly happens, there's always a potential of killing this young king or taking over or him having to choose sides and so on. And the priests of Amun stepped in and said, oh yeah, if you join us, we'll protect you, but you need to change your name from Atun to Amun, because apparently these were not the same god. Though Atun resembles to some degree Amun-Re, the sun god, but it doesn't really matter. But you need to know there was a competition. There was a competition between the temples, between the priests of Amun and the priests of, I think it was the priests of Osiris. I don't remember, this was quite a while ago when I studied this. And they competed between them as well. They competed over the calendar and so on. So in Egypt, there was a competition between the different deities. There was one main deity in the eyes of most people, remember that there's a strong connection between temples, money, banking, and things like that. So there was always a competition. Then this way the calendars changed all the time. And I'll get to Israel and I'll point out something about that as well. And what happened is that the Egyptians were governed by several things. They were governed by the floods of the Nile, and they actually were able to bring down the floods of the Nile to a mathematical structure, to a mathematical calculation of when things happened. There's actually these temples that I've seen, or like watershore temples, where you would see a calendar that's based on, well, at this point of the year, the water is supposed to come up to here. Then another point of the year, water is supposed to come up to here. Another point of the year, the water has to come up to here. And they were governed by the floods. The floods are from the Blue and White Nile, Lake Victoria, all the way deeper in Africa. And that was one thing. The other thing they had was the obvious seasons of the year. Though they're not really a rainy country, so they wouldn't really have that much rain. So summer and winter are more or less the same. And then they had the rise of the star of Osiris. Is Osiris? Yeah, I think it should be Osiris. And that's another point in time. So the calendar they were using at one point was connected to both. And then obviously you had the physical year that had to come into play as well. So they also had two calendars side by side, because taxes were also very important. However, because the Egyptians were less concerned about seasons and more concerned about floods, for them, what they did to keep feasts in specific points in time of the year, instead of adding a month, they would add days. So their mechanism was connected to adding 4 days every year, so you don't end up celebrating something what's technically winter. It does rain in Egypt, by the way. It's important to point out. It's not the Sahara Desert. It's not that really dry, the Death Valley and whatever that. I covered someone in the United States called Death Valley. American geography is not really something I know. And it's nothing like that. What they basically had. They did have rain, but it wasn't as much. They really relied more on floodings, and this is why the Torah specifically says, "V'hishkita kegan ha'erak." You don't have the floods; you have to actually collect the water and water your fields, like the gan ha'erak, which is a garden or a vegetable field. So they had completely different considerations of how the calendar works. Their new year, by the way, also happened in springtime. The month of Nisan. But as far as I know from what I've read, and again, I might be wrong, I don't know everything, they celebrated only during the spring. And again, the fertility thing, there was a whole thing about a statue of Amun and a bunch of theories there about what the statue specifically looked like. And there's a lot of attention there to the fertility part. So there's a lot of stuff about it. I don't want to expand on it. It's use the imagination. And so one of the questions that comes up with seeing these two calendars, and there's also the Ethiopian calendar and a whole bunch of other calendars that exist, the Greek calendar. Greek calendar. It's mentioned the Greek calendar. The Greek calendar was a lunar calendar. The Greek calendar actually was really lunar solar, but there's a strong focus there on the lunar. And this lunar subject came into play very seriously later on in the Second Temple period. Now, the other thing that needs to be pointed out here is the reality of the land of Israel. The land of Israel is more like Mesopotamia. The fact that we depend on rain and we don't really have floods makes us very Mesopotamian, which means that the chances are very, very high that the calendar used in this region was more in the style of the Mesopotamian calendar. Now, we mentioned last time, we started with the first verses of chapter 12. And the first verse of chapter 12 clearly point to Chodesh Hazeh Lachem, Rosh Chodeshim u'Lechodshei HaShana. This month is the head of all the months of the year. So obviously the year begins in springtime, what we'll call the month of Nisan, just for the need for specific names to make life a little tad easier. That's the only reason I use this. On the other hand, they also had a physical year, and this physical year was based on a tax year. So it seems to be extremely logical that there were two calendars functioning simultaneously in biblical Israel. But we need to remember that the most important calendar for the Israelites was the feast calendar, because the Torah is a covenant with the God of Israel, not a covenant with the king. They had the biblical calendar, the calendar the Torah ascribes, which seems to be lunar solar, and I'll explain that in a second. But they also have, the moment they have leadership and having to pay taxes, they needed a physical year, which meant that they had to create a what we'll call secular, quote-unquote, calendar, so they can manage the country. And he can't walk up to people after winter and say, pay me your taxes. Taxes from what? You know, I have to give my tithes to the temple. And now you're also walking up to me asking for taxes. So, you know, at least if you're going to ask for taxes, you know, it's at least, you know, do it in a reasonable time. But in any case, it seems to be this was the reality. Now, why did I say it seems to be lunar solar? There's the classic point, the classic argument that it says, Shamo at Chodesh Aviv. You have to observe the month of Aviv. You have to make sure that this feast known as Pesach, And the next feast immediately after, adjacent to it, Chag HaMatzot, will all fall in the month of Aviv, because you have to bring young sheep, and you're celebrating your barley, and you're celebrating later on your wheat, and so on. There's a strong connection between the agricultural cycle of the land and when the feast is done. So you have to make sure that not only do you keep into that square known as month, which is Chodesh, which is obviously lunar, though you can create artificial months, and we'll later on see examples of artificial months. You also need to make sure that you keep inside something solar, something which happens in a specific season of the year. So this is why it seems to be that the calendar is lunar solar. When the day begins, again, if it's lunar solar, it opens up possibilities here. The world begins in darkness, so therefore people say it begins in the day, and there are a few verses that support that. And then there's a lot of verses that talk about things only during the day. I usually call that the cultic time frame. Temple is only done during the day. At nighttime, there is no temple service. The temple is closed. And therefore, everything in the temple is a function of the day. I remember I read like not long ago an explanation why only during the day and what's the whole deal with the night. Unfortunately, I don't remember what I read there, so I'm going to have to skip that. In any case, that seems to be the case. Now, when the Judeans and the Ephraimites, or when Judah and Ephraim separated from one another, Yerovam played an interesting game. He didn't change the calendar. The Book of Kings says that Vayas Hag B'Chodesh HaShemini K'Hag Asher B'Yerushalayim. But he did a feast on the eighth month as the feast in Jerusalem. The word Hag is a word that for many, many, many centuries, even in Mishnei Hebrew, even in the Mishnah and the Talmud, is another name for the month of the feast of Sukkot, the feast of booths. But I don't like the term booths because booth really means one thing, Sukkah is something else. But the point is that he didn't change the calendar. He played a completely different trick. What he did there is he said, look, Aviv here up in the north doesn't happen when it happens in Judea. We can't celebrate based on what they do. We're the majority. And therefore it must be according to what goes up here in the north. And what he did is that he basically said the new month, the first month of the year happens in many cases a month later. And really, I lived in the north and south parts of the land of Israel. I've lived in the Galilee, I've lived in Samaria, I've lived in Judea, I've been on several Aviv searches and so on. And I know there's a difference. I actually go out to see what the fields are doing here, and it's always a month later. The Samaritans, for example, tend to have their celebrations of Hag HaMatzot and the Pesach. And with them, it's literally Pesach. They actually do a Pesach celebration. They actually slaughter sheep, big ones. I'm very doubtful if those sheep are really inside a first year. And if you want to read about that, if you go to my blog, there's an article there known as "How Old Am I?" And that blog, I discuss the subject of what it means Ben Shana. Is it a year old or in the first year? There's a problem with this genitive of Ben Shana, this construct state of Ben Shana. But in any case, that's basically what he did. He said, look, the Aviv is a month later. So the Samaritans and we usually do the Passover at the same time is when we have a leap year and they don't have one and somehow they correlate. But usually in the mindset of what they do, it's always a month later. So that's what he did. And there's quite a few scholars that say it's quite possible that, in the north, they emphasized more the idea of the physical year because there was a strong kingship identity. There's actually a massive difference between the north and the south when it comes to kingship identity. The kings of Judea were more humble. They built smaller. They didn't put monuments and so on. The kings of Israel, Ephraim, built big. So because of this very strong identity of kingship, there's this theory that says in the northern kingdom, the idea of having a physical year and a tax year became very strong and very popular. While in Judea, they were less interested in this. However, by the end of the 8th century, especially with the murder of Yoram, king of Israel, by Yehu, son of Nimshi, and Yehu surrenders to Assyria. By that point, the problem that they had is they had to pay taxes to Assyria, which Assyria, as we know, as a fact, had a physical year. And therefore, that calendar became even more important because if you didn't pay your taxes to Assyria, they would come and kill you because not paying your taxes meant that you're rebelling. By the year 720, 721, the northern kingdom was destroyed. Judea came under threat by the year 720, 721 when the northern kingdom was destroyed. There was no more border that protected them from the north. Jerusalem goes under siege around the year 701 BC. This is to the common calculation. I'm not going to go into the whole discussion of the exact calculation, the flaws with the chronologies and so on. The official is 701. Judea has to pay taxes to Assyria after years of rebellion and not paying your taxes. This is why he came here. This area, Judea, Israel, Phoenicia, Kulia Syria, Great Syria, and so on. This was the backwaters of everything. No one cared about this, but they wanted their money. They need to pay. They need to fund these conquests. So you know, this is what you do. You go out and you conquer. And so they actually came under the rule of the physical year of Assyria as well. So for hundreds of years in Judea as well, they had to pay taxes. Assyrians were conquered by Babylon, though it was still basically the Assyrians. They were still using the same physical year. The Persians conquer Babylon. The Medes and the Persians conquer Babylon. They didn't change anything. Nothing changed. There was no reason to change anything. Now, during this period of Assyria-Babylon, King Menashe went more with the Egyptians, so he might have paid Egyptian taxes. Maybe there was a slightly different calendar at that time. But the main point is that for many years, especially after King Hezekiah, Judea was under someone else's rule and under someone else's calendar. And it just became natural after hundreds of years. Remember, 701 was the siege on Jerusalem, but for many years before that, they were already under attack by Assyria, under attack by Egypt. We know that King Josiah, there was a struggle there over which side they pick. King Menashe, Hezekiah's son, chose the side of the Egyptians. We know this, especially he rebelled against Assyria, though he did bring the Syria and Babylon. Though he did, but it seems to be at one point, the Book of Chronicles mentions that he actually was taken captive and was saved. There was a miraculous save. It doesn't say how he was saved. There's a miraculous save there, but he called his son Amun. That's a very Egyptian name. So it shows that he actually leaned more towards the Egyptians. So in any case, the situation that we have here is that by the middle of the 8th century, 700, somewhere in the middle, by the year 586, they were under the physical year of Mesopotamia for probably about 150 years. It became natural after several generations for that to be another year. Now, from that point on, Babylon, Persia, they were under the physical year of these people, and therefore having that as a new year of sorts was natural. It doesn't seem to be that they believed that this was the new year based on the Bible, but it was obvious to them that this is another type of new year. They accepted the fact that there's a tax year. I mean, I'm not going to be surprised if the kings of Judea understood that this is a tax year, but one may argue that they didn't emphasize this because they understood that if they emphasize it, it will undermine the Bible. It will undermine the calendar of the Torah, and they were the rulers of Jerusalem. This is the city of God. This is the temple of the king and the temple of the God of Israel. This is where the ark dwells. So they were very careful in not overemphasizing, and this emphasis only came much later. Now, the Judeans come back. There are people already living here in the land anyhow and so on, but they're still under the physical year. So it seems to be that no matter what they did, they were under for hundreds of years under the physical year of Mesopotamia. And then we have the whole struggle with the Judicians and Seleucians and the Ptolemies or the Ptolemy kingdom and so on. And we have to jump ahead into the Second Temple period. So everything was nice and dandy. We don't really hear much. I mean, we have letters and inscriptions, and this guy was dealing with that thing, and that guy was dealing with that thing, and there were Jews who were involved in trades of all sorts, and people working here, and people paying their taxes, and so on. However, Alexander the Great shows up. He comes from the West. Oh, wait. I have to stop here for a second. I forgot something very, very important. This is super duper important. This is actually one of the pinnacle points of this discussion, and I completely forgot about it. Give me a second. Drink something. Sorry, I'm drinking so much. The air is extremely dry. It's November and it's dry. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to share my screen. And I am going to be showing you a calendar of sorts. And this calendar is known as the Gezel calendar. Gezel, let me make sure that everyone can see this. Please make sure that you can see this document. It's all in Hebrew. I'm going to basically kind of translate. And Gezel is an ancient city on the the Judean plateau. It's not too far away from the land of Philistines. Gezel, by the way, in Hebrew means carrot, but it's not the origins of the name. And Gezel basically is mentioned by, it's mentioned in the Book of Kings, it's mentioned in the Book of Yeshua, they were unable to conquer it. It's actually, it was a well-fortified city, and it was a very, it's a very interesting sight to see. You can see everything from Gezel, by the way. Actually, if you go to all the tells in that area of Shvelat Yehuda, the Judean Plateau, there are certain sites that are so high up that you can really see every single road out there. That's why Gezel was so important. It was a strategic point that you could see the main roads. And by the way, these main roads are used to this very day. They might not be exactly where the original road was, but they're very, very close. And what's amazing about Gezel is that it was unconquerable. And it says that the Pharaoh conquered Gezel and gave it to his daughter as a gift for her wedding with King Solomon. And Gezel was dug in the 1920s by McAllister. I think it was 1920s by McAllister. He made a mess of the site. He dug strips and dumped from one strip, strips of holes into the ground, and dumped from one to the other. He mixed layers. He made a mess out of everything. And there is literally no way to fix this mess. You go there, you have, to this very day, you can still see the holes that he dug and the mounds he created. The guy's method was abysmal. I mean, I sat with an archaeologist, and there was nothing nice he could say about McAllister. Nothing. We went to Lachish, where Starkey dug. It was wonderful, and he did this and did that. There's even stuff, actually now digging again in Lachish, because there are entire areas that they couldn't dig. There's even a section there under the Assyrian ramp that has, to this very day, untouched layers. And everyone was like, we must, I mean, we're sitting there with the archaeologists, and they go, we want to open this up, but we shouldn't because it can ruin things and so on. We can ruin the ramp and the whole dilemma they have there. But Gezel, what's important about Gezel is this plate that they found. And this plate contains a description of agricultural stages of the year. So it's called the Gezel calendar as well. And it actually begins in the seventh month. And it reads like this. What you have here in bold is the inscription, but it's written in Paleo Hebrew. And it says, Yerho Asif, Yerho Zera, Yerho Lekesh. Now, the thing about it is they didn't have much space. So they would sometimes write a part of a word, like the Zayin here in line one, sits in the end of the line, but really connects to line two. Now the word Yerho, there's a dilemma about what the word Yerho means. Some people think it's a case ending. Case endings are either genitive or accusative. They create basically what we call an older form of the construct state, month of such and such. It's the closest thing that you can translate in English in this situation. Month of, the first one is Asif or Asaf, which is gathering, month of gathering. Another opinion says that Yerho is a dual form, 2 months of gathering. And then you have Yerho Zera, 2 months or the month of seeding. Yerho Lekesh, which is late seeding, which has to do with the late rains. Yerach Etzed, or Yerho Etzed. And there's Etzed Pashat, which is really a month that there's a debate what Etzed is. because it's a rare word. Some people think it has to do with plowing the ground for the flax. Some people think maybe it has to do with grinding the flax or breaking the flax off. Yerach Katzel Seorim. You can see it's all spelt with almost no vowel consonants. The months of the harvest of barley. Yerach Katzer V'chal. The months of harvest, harvesting everything, actually harvesting all the grains. V'chal. Chal means that it ends. It's the same word actually appears in the book of Isaiah as well. Yerho Zemer, Yerho Katz. Yerho Zemer, the 2 months of Zemer. Zemer is the description of how we, it's the verb of cutting down the vines. And Yerach Katzer, kites, or Yerach Katz, kites, the fruits of summer, which is also the fruits that you dry up. We'll send this out with images and so on to everyone later. I was planning on sending this out before the lesson, and I forgot. I apologize for that. I will make sure I rectify that. In any case, let's stop the sharing here so you see me again. And what's very interesting about this calendar is it's an agricultural calendar, and it takes into consideration the agricultural reality of life. And therefore, the calendar for whomever wrote this begins with plowing the ground after the first rain. So it's a situation of we don't care about the month of Nisan, because that's the middle of work. We're going to be talking, we care about more about the beginning of work. So this proves, if we consider this to be the way a farmer considers his year, this will be evidence of the year in some practices to begin actually in the month of Nisan. Now, by the end of the struggle between the north and the south, the Seleucians and the Ptolemies, the Egyptian kingdom that developed under the different Ptolemies or Ptolemies, several groups emerged, and one of these groups wanted to make themselves very unique and special because they believed that they were holier than everyone else. And we can't call them Essenes. I'm not going to call them Essenes because this is still a debated subject among scholars, who exactly wrote these books. But in the Book of Jubilee, we find this interesting sentence. In the Book of Jubilee, I don't remember what chapter. I'm going to have to take a sneak peek here in something. In the Book of Jubilee, Temple Scroll, it says that there will be those who would look to the moon, for the months, and would ignore the sun, something like that. If I remember the whole thing about saying specifically, they would look at the moon, and they really were trying to say the year begins, you calculate the year based on the sun. Now, the theory that I heard from several people that taught me, my own teachers or people that I read and so on, is that this was more of a response. This is some kind of a fake orthodoxy. Because orthodoxy is the sticking to the words and the avoidance of, in many situations, the avoidance of anything new, especially when it comes to Jewish orthodoxy. Jewish orthodoxy actually is an interesting paradox. If we ever get around talking about that, we might. But the thing that developed was that this group of people were against the idea of using the moon. But the reason they did this is because they saw the Greek calendar, which was based on the moon, and therefore they wanted to keep away from it. This is why I say it's a fake orthodoxy, because it actually rejects something which seems to be very clear in the Tanakh itself. But the problem they had is they ignored the moon, and therefore their months were based completely on the sun, and they had to create this fake calendar. Let's say quite fake, but this calendar that, based on discussions I had with different people about this, this calendar had no chance of surviving. So there's this. They might have used this calendar for 100 or 200 years, but they probably realized it was unrealistic. But let me share the screen again and show you something else, another piece about this calendar. So I need to bring up this. Oh, wait, what am I doing? Oh, sorry. I need to open this page. Okay, so let me. So what we have here in front of us, this is actually the Qumran calendar. Now, their rule was as follows. This is only the first 7 months, because this is where it's most relevant for the feasts and so on. But their rule was that a month was a month is 30 days, where the first month must begin on a Wednesday. And the whole idea, so you can see this is a Chodesh HaRishon, the first month, this is the first day. This is the days of the month, the right column is day of the month. The left, the next column is the day of the week, marked with Hebrew alphabet, and then feast and so on. So for them, the rule was that the year had to begin on a Wednesday, and that begins the first month. And the day of Chag HaMatzot had to fall on a Wednesday as well. The waving of the sheaf, the barley sheaf, had to fall on a Sunday after the feast of Chag HaMatzot, so that falls on the 26th day. And then the days of each feast fall on specific days of the year, where the date and the day are always the same. Now, besides the regular feast that we have in the Hebrew calendar, this is by the way the calendar based on Yigal Yadin's reconstruction. They also have in the Book of Jubilees, it mentions, the Book of Jubilees, it mentions a few more feasts like Bikurei Chitim. Oh yeah. So also what happens is Shavuot always falls on the 15th day of the third month. It's always falls on a Sunday. And it's called Bikurei Chitim, the first fruits of wheat. And then on the fifth month, every 50 days, there's something else. So 50 days after the barley, there's wheat. 50 days after the wheat, there's the vine. 50 days after the vine, there's all the rest of the trees, including olive trees and so on. And then we have the first day of the seventh month always falls on a Wednesday, which is, by the way, the opposite of the rabbinic rule, Lo Adu Rosh, that the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Tov, never falls on a Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday. Yom Kippur always falls on a Friday, and Chag Sukkot always falls on a Wednesday. So this calendar is very, very artificial. A month is never always 30 days, but then they have another problem. The other problem that they have is that they always have these extra days. And these extra days, okay, as you can see, the first month ends on a Thursday. The second month begins on a Friday, ends on a Saturday. The third month begins on a Sunday, but then it has 31 days, which is unnatural. But then, which is unnatural to a moon cycle, the fourth month begins on a Wednesday, which is a direct continuation of the third month. But then the fourth month has only 30 days, and it actually skips on Friday and Saturday. Because the fifth month begins, it doesn't skip there, sorry. The 30th day straight into the first day, the first day of the fifth month is a Friday. But then what happens here is along the line, this is probably someone's mistake, this 31 day here, but I've heard people explain this, that they actually, on the fifth month, it did have a 31 day, but this was what's called the missing days. And that they had like these, these special days that were not counted. So these were Yamim Asher Lo Olim B'Cheshbon. These were days that they had to deliberately omit. So their year fits into, into another structure. So this is a calendar, and I've never really sat down to really dig deep into this calendar, but there's a lot of literature there, and really the entire lectures you can give just on the Qumrani calendar. But this was a calendar that they developed separately to, we can switch back to not sharing. They basically developed this calendar as a counter calendar to the common calendar that most Jews were holding to, which was a lunar solar. They were trying to remove the lunar part of the calendar in this idea that they were actually following the original calendar and so on. By the way, that tells you the Book of Jubilees is not an ancient book. It's a book that is what we call pseudo. It presents itself as being ancient, but based on what we can reconstruct from it and the points that it makes and so on, we can prove that it's a very late book. We can prove that it's like second or third century BC. So that's another calendar that existed in this region. Now, Rachel Eliur, who's more into Judaics and Hasidic studies, but because she deals with Kabbalah, she had to deal with some of the Dead Sea Scrolls because there is a connection, as Dr. Yosef Dan proved in his massive series on Kabbalah. I have only the first three volumes. If I understand, there's like 15 volumes by now or something. This is a massive work on Kabbalah. It's very interesting. A little difficult to follow because he just runs very quickly through everything because there's so much to say. She claims that this was written by Sadducees, and this is the original calendar. The Sadducees were priests, and therefore it was the Pharisees that invented this lunar solar calendar. I wrote to Rachel Eliur saying, you know, with all due respect, it doesn't make any sense, and I explained why. There's a lot of evidence isn't, and so on. And she tries to make this claim that even the P source actually holds to this. And I said to her, my response was, the P source is obviously not saying that. This is your own reading into it. It doesn't say that. Unfortunately, there's a fine line between what things are actually saying and what your interpretation is trying to say. Rachel Eliur has been pushing this idea for many years now. I've read her articles, I've read books, I've listened to lectures. She has not convinced me one bit. Her points are very, very weak. But she's not the only one who makes this claim. This is strongly connected to who actually wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it's extremely questionable if the Qumran community wrote the scrolls. There's actually not clear if there actually is any evidence that there's a connection between the scrolls and the caves and the village. The theory, the idea that there's a scriptorium in Qumran is something Roland Devaux invented, and he looked for a very early monastery. It's been proven that it was not a monastery village. They actually were very wealthy there. They were heavily involved in the production of Farsiman oil, which is a very, very expensive oil. They sat next to a major road. Really, the whole story, what most people know about Qumran is probably not true. It was invented by people in the 1950s, 1960s with a lot of romantic ideas in their heads. In any case, we've covered here a lot of information, a lot of points about calendars and so on. Last point I have to make. The Jewish calendar, up to about 1,000 years ago, was the biblical calendar. What we use today as a calendar, the calculated calendar and so on, became the only calendar for a very long time because of the Crusades. The Crusades destroyed the Jewish community of Syria, Greater Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Egypt. The Crusaders tried to go into Egypt as well. They messed up there pretty big time. In 1143, they tried to go into Egypt. It was a mess. I think it was 1143. And the story goes like this. When the Second Temple was destroyed, the Sanhedrin still existed. The old traditions still existed. They weren't called Pharisees anymore. They were called the sages. They were called just Jews, because Sadducees and Essenes kind of had to vanish because there was no center, especially the Sadducees. There were splinter groups. The Pharisees became the main entity of Judaism because really just reality dictated that. And for a very long time, you look at the Mishnah, you look at the Talmud, unlike some Judaic professors, especially the religious ones, I'm going to openly admit, religious, Orthodox Jewish academics sometimes create a very bad, they do create a bad name for such a field, and they do a disservice for the field. I've heard people, you know, who are academics in their respected Jewish studies fields and so on, and I've heard rubbish about the calendar like you wouldn't believe. One guy says, oh yeah, this is new movement that wants to start looking at the moon. This is a new thing. I said, what do you mean it's a new thing? What do you even study? What have you studied? What kind of literature have you studied for the love of God? This one guy says, oh, the word Aviv, now people are trying to claim that it has to do with the barley. This is not true. I said, I wrote to this guy saying, who are you kidding? What? Just stay there. Don't make comments. I mean, I actually publicly wrote to this person, you're making silly comments. I wrote, I'm a Bible scholar. My profession is actually teaching biblical Hebrew. And I can tell as a fact, it means this. And you have stuff like that. But basically what happened was that the more people spread and the more it became difficult to send out the message, yeah, people started appearing up in Carthage and in the western side of Africa, and people already going into Germany. By the sixth century, we have the sages of Italy corresponding with Jews in Germany. The students of Colonimus, son of Colonimus, was basically the Gaonite of one of the Gaonites of Italy. Though we don't call those ones. Gaonites are usually reserved for land of Israel, Egypt, and Babylon. Those are the people who receive those names. Something Geon Yaakov, it was a title they gave the head of the yeshivat. In the land of Israel, even after the destruction of everything and the Muslim conquest and so on, and living in Usha, which is not too far away from where I live, by the way, and living in Tiberias and the Sanhedrin moving from place to place, Sanhedrin continued to exist. In Babylon, it was easier to calculate. So Hillel II, what he did is he created a formula. And the formula, it seems to be, even in the Talmud and tractate of Rosh Hashanah, it seems to be that the formula was calculated to be able to see the actual moon. And people in the land of Israel continued to go out and sight the moon to confirm the calculation. In Babylon, it became easier just to use the calculation. So there were actually discrepancies between the West and the East. There were discrepancies between Babylon, which contains Persia and other areas as well, and the West, Syria, southern Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and in Egypt. And then in Italy, and everything there in the West was Kirwan and so on. There's a whole bunch of questions what went on there. They corresponded with both places. I'm not too sure exactly what went on there. But by the 10th century, Rav Saadia Gaon, who was the rabbi of Pumbadita, one of the great study halls of Babylon, writes in his Siddur, his prayer book, which is not just a prayer book, it's a lot of halachot and stuff like that there, a lot of laws, he states that the moon has never been sighted on the first day of the year. Basically on Yom Tov, Rosh Hashanah. Which proves that by that point in Babylon, they only went according to the calculation. Now, we need to understand Rav Saadia Gaon. Rav Saadia Gaon was an orthodox. He was very orthodox, but orthodoxy can also create heterodoxy. He stuck to this calculation to a point. where he argued, and they actually have these letters at home, he argued with Ben Meir, who was the Geonite of the land of Israel, was the head of the yeshiva of the land of Israel, Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael. He argued with him about what's known as a molad zaken, a late conjunction. That's Tarmav Chalakim, which is 642 particles. I think each particle is like 6 seconds or something. I remember exactly how they calculate it. Maybe less, maybe each particle is 4 seconds. I don't remember. Basically, the conjunction happens later. When do you actually call conjunction and so on, and when do you celebrate new moons? And they go back and forth, arguing, and he says, oh yeah, but, you know, based on, seeing the moon, we know that it's this and that. So Rav Saadia Gaon represents a very theoretical side of things. A lot of things about him are extremely theoretical, and that's one of the problems with orthodoxy. It's very theoretical sometimes. And while Ben Meir represents an actual thing. So Rav Saadia Gaon writes to him. He says to him, yeah, this is all nice and dandy if you go out and sight the moon. Ben Meir says, what do you mean? We do. What this proves is that in the land of Israel, for a very, very long time, they sighted the moon. And what we do today is a new idea, relatively new. It became important to go according to the calculation because there was no longer a cent in the land of Israel. By 1095, when Urbanus II declared the crusade, and they came by 1096, they came to Jerusalem, they destroyed the Jewish community. The Jewish community had to run away. There's actually, my brother has a theory that the area that my family came from Europe, they actually came from the land of Israel. So we might actually be able to trace our heritage into the land of Israel as Jews who lived here from the Second Temple period, which means my family was away from the land of Israel for about 1,000 years, less than 1,000 years, and we came back. Okay, more like less 800-something years we went to live here and we came back. Explains why my people in my family are so dark and really look very Mediterranean. I'm mixed. My mother's very white, so I didn't come out that dark. But my uncle, my father, and the rest of the family, they're all very, very dark people. And what it shows, and this is, there's actually a book that I really need to find. I have it somewhere in a PDF on my computer. It's a very interesting book about the Jewish calendar. And what we practice today is relatively new. This calculation is what we can call new, quote unquote. So it's less than 1,000 years. It's about 1,000 years been in use since it's 1095 but even then, people who ran away to Egypt or to other areas maybe kept that. In any case, the Pharisaic calendar originally was based on actually sighting the moon, and that's how the Mishnah and Talmud talk about it. But later on, it changed because of people's orthodoxy or heterodoxy, I will call it. There's a very interesting book about orthodoxy and heterodoxy and how orthodoxy can be heterodoxy and so on. It's an interesting read. But the point is, that was the original calendar. When people said, oh, yeah, this is not true, this is Karaites are inventing this, that's unfortunately very, very incorrect historically. I've seen people write about this on Facebook and so on, saying, oh yeah, there's this people who convince other people to become Karaites, and they have this calendar and so on, and it's against the sages, and this is not true. It's actually the exact, historically speaking, it's the exact opposite. Everything that happened with the calendar after the destruction of the community in the land of Israel was heterodoxy, and stood in sharp contradiction to the practices of the sages. Hillel II, who created the calculated calendar, the pre-calculated calendar, his intention, based on what we can tell from the tractate of Rosh Hashanah and other sources, his intention was to calculate to actually see the moon. The problem is, a moon cycle is not exactly 29.5. And there are times when the moon appears after 29 days, times when the moon appears after 30 days, and it can variate and change, which means in several decades or several hundred years, you will no longer be able to see the moon, and you have to readjust it. And this is actually, I actually read an article written by a Judaics professor here in Israel, or a researcher, you know, he was just a researcher, he wasn't just a researcher, not a professor. He said that we actually might have to adjust the calendar to accommodate the changes and so on. In any case, we never got to the text. This was basically a lesson about calendars, which is a precursor to the next section of the Book of Exodus. So I'm gonna stop the recording here. So this was the 22nd of November 2015.